Lead seeped into Flint, Michigan's drinking water after the city switched its water supply in 2014. Scholars, activists, and politicians still argue about whether race and wealth were factors in the series of steps that led to this disaster. Most people who live in Flint are black, and 40% of Flint's residents live in poverty. Now, people knew there was something wrong with the water, and they complained, but city and state officials denied and or ignored their complaints for months. None of this ever had to happen. Now, this ongoing crisis was entirely preventable, according to Mona Hanna Atisha. She is the Flint pediatrician who proved Flint's drinking water was poisoning the city's children. Her book, What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City, is a first-person account of how Governor Snyder's attempt to save money using Flint river water turned into an environmental, public health, and political disaster. It's published by Random House. Mona, welcome.
It's great to be here.
Now, you write, the switch in water supply was the result of an ideology of extreme austerity. Why was Flint under such a severe austerity program?
So Flint has an incredible history. So the birthplace of General Motors, birthplace of cars, the birthplace of the middle class. At one point, the people of Flint had the highest per capita income, some of the lowest unemployment in the country. But that all changed really since the 1980s. Flint has been in crisis and led to almost a near bankruptcy state because of that severe disinvestment and unemployment and poverty and racism. So in Michigan, if you're under a financial emergency status near bankruptcy, the state can swoop in and usurp democracy. So in 2000...
Swoop in and usurp democracy.
Absolutely. So we became under the control of the state in this financial emergency management state. And the emergency manager was accountable to the governor. And their only goal was to save money, save money, save money, save money. And under that mindset of austerity, they decided to save money by switching our water supply. So Flint, Michigan is in the middle of the Great Lakes, literally in the middle of the largest source of fresh water in the world. For half a century, we'd been getting our water from the Great Lakes via Detroit. We would buy it from our Detroits, but it was fresh Great Lakes water. Flint said, hey, let's save money. Let's start drawing water from our local Flint River until a new pipeline to the Great Lakes was to be built. So in April of 2014, switched to the Flint River, but the water was not treated properly.
And because they wanted to save money.
Yes. It was all a cost-cutting move to save money because the price of that Great Lakes water was too expensive for this poor city.
Two things are striking about what you're saying, that this area was the birth of the American middle class. But I'm also struck by the fact that 40% live in poverty. Do you believe class and race were a factor?
Absolutely. So 40% of the total population is in poverty. Almost 60% of our children live in poverty in Flint. 58% childhood poverty rate. It is astronomical. We are the poorest city in the country. We are 60% minority. We're the eighth largest majority minority city. About 60% of our population is African American in a city that is largely poor. This absolutely would not have happened in a richer and a whiter city. That has been said repeatedly. Jesse Jackson called Flint a crime scene. Michael Moore, who is from Flint, called it not an accident, that it would not have happened in a city with a demographic that was richer and whiter.
So to play devil's advocate, what would a richer and wider city have done beforehand? What could such a city have stopped from happening?
Sure. So there would have been democracy in those cities. There would have been officials who were held accountable. Flint had no democracy because it was usurped because of this emergency manager law. The emergency managers were not held accountable to the people. They did not have to respond to the people. If this would have happened in another community, you would have had advocates fighting for you and hearing your concerns. The people of Flint were heroic. They were raising their voices. They were holding jugs of brown water at town hall meetings, and they were literally being arrested. So this is an amazing example where democracy was taken away, and the voice, the powerful, the incredible, the brave voices of the people of Flint were not being listened to.
So the water was coming from the Flint River. Why was that river contaminated?
So it wasn't the river. This was not the river's fault. And many people think, oh, it's the river's fault, you know, decades of industrial pollution, even though the river does have a bad rap. And it's been known to actually have caught on fire twice in its history because of that legacy of industry. But the problem was that it wasn't being treated properly. And I've learned much about water engineering that I've never ever wanted to know. but I see it as a medicine was missing. So the treatment of water is an art, and there's different ingredients that you have to put into the treatment of water. And one of those ingredients is something called corrosion control or corrosion inhibitors. And you have to put that in the water to prevent whatever's in the pipes from corroding and coming out of the pipes and into the water. And that ingredient, that simple ingredient, was not added to the Flint water treatment. And we found out later that it only would have cost $80 to $100 a day to add that ingredient. And that was not added, and that pump to even install that chemical was never even installed.
It seems like such a deadly miscalculation. How is this possible? I don't understand.
It's mind-boggling. You know, there's laws in the book, there's guidelines of what you have to do, and those things weren't followed. Even when the state was told by the EPA, you need to add this ingredient, you need to do corrosion control, it didn't do it. And that's why we have criminal charges.
So it's customary to test drinking water that's being supplied to people. Was this water tested?
Evidently not enough. So the corrosion control testing was not enough. And I don't know all the details of that. But the necessary testing before it became drinking water was not done. And you know, this is the 21st century. This is not like 19th century London with cholera epidemics. Like, we assume I'm drinking water right now in your beautiful studio. Like, I hope it's safe. And I'm assuming it is safe, although New York City does have the most lead pipes in the country. But I'm sure it's been treated properly. But like, you assume in this day and age that when you open, you know, you turn on your tap and the water comes out, that there's these people, I imagine them in my head with like white coats, and they have test tubes in their hand, and they're testing the water to make sure that the water that we drink, that we consume, that we feed our babies, that we mix formula in, comes out and it's safe. I mean, that's basic public health. Water is fundamental to societies and civilization.
We give people the benefit of the doubt, but in this situation, we shouldn't have. Now, by the time that the water supply shifted back to the Detroit's Lake Huron, had the pipes in Flint been damaged? At what point was it just a lost cause?
Pretty much. So for 18 months, from April 2014 to October 2015, we were on this untreated corrosive water. And that ate up our pipes. And that is why, to this day, people are still unfiltered and bottled water, because our pipes are being replaced. So those damaged lead pipes need to be replaced, and we are in that process right now.
Do you consider yourself the person who brought this system to bear? I mean, do you take credit for that?
No, I don't. I consider myself a piece in a series of dominoes, and I just happen to be that last domino. This crisis unfolded because of so many amazing folks, primarily the people of Flint. They are the heroes of the story. They were activists, and they were protesting, and they were raising their voices, teamed together with incredible journalists who kept digging and digging and digging, pastors and other activists and water scientists. And I was just the last domino that had the evidence, that had the science, that spoke truth to power. But it never should have gotten to the point of me. We never should have had to have evidence that children were being exposed to lead for this crisis to end.
You're an incredibly heavy domino. You're the director of the Michigan State University Hurley Children's Hospital Pediatric Public Health Initiative. What prompted you to say, this is a problem? Was there a moment when you thought, my God, I have to devote time, resources, and gather evidence? Because clearly the statements, the testimony of these people holding jugs of water is not enough.
Right. So, you know, I had been telling my kids in Flint, my patients, the kids I take care of every day, they'd be coming in and the moms would be like, is this water okay? And I was reassuring them that it was okay.
Ugh.
You know, we heard about bacteria, but then that was being treated. And we heard about other things, and the state said everything's okay, everything's in compliance. And I was passing on that message for about 17 months. And the point that changed my direction happened to be at my house over a glass of wine with a high school girlfriend who happened to be a water expert. And she's like, hey, Mona, have you heard about the Flint water? I'm like, yeah, you know, the problems. We switched, but everything's okay. I'm telling my patients everything's okay. She's like, well, it's not okay. I'm like, well, what are you talking about? And she's like, you know, it's not being treated with something called corrosion control. I'm like, okay, I have no idea what that is. What are you talking about? She's like, there's going to be lead in your water. And from the moment I heard the word lead, this my trajectory changed. And there was no unknowing that. There was only moving forward. When a pediatrician hears the word lead, when anybody in the world of public health hears the word lead, we freak out. Lead is a potent, irreversible neurotoxin. It is already a form of environmental injustice or environmental racism. It already disproportionately impacts our most vulnerable children everywhere in the country. And when I heard that our kids in Flint, who already had so many obstacles to their success, were going to be or were already exposed to lead, that there was no going back. And I needed to know if that lead was in the drinking water and if it was getting into their bodies.
So she told you it was going to happen, but by then it was already happening.
It had been going on for about 17 months.
How do you deal with the... with knowing that for many, many months you told
Absolutely.
People that it was safe?
Yeah, no, it's incredible guilt. As a pediatrician, I literally took an oath to protect children. I took an oath to stand up and be their healer, to be their protector. As a pediatrician, so much of my job every day is making sure that the kid in front of me is healthy and safe. But so much of what we do as pediatricians is protecting the potential of our children, from telling them to eat right and wear helmets and get your immunizations. That's all about tomorrow. And yet here I was recommending and telling folks, hey, the water's okay. Yet it was loaded with a neurotoxin that forever could change the trajectory of their tomorrows. So it was an incredible sense of guilt for me, for my profession, for my duty. And that's why there was no going back. Once I knew that, I could only move forward.
So when you found out about this possibility, 17 months had already passed. Is
right.
that right?
Correct.
There is a clock that's ticking. How long does it take from the moment a child starts ingesting lead for it to show up in his or her bloodstream?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And that kind of gets to the title of my book, What the Eyes Don't See. So you often do not see the consequences of lead exposure. So lead in water is also invisible. It's colorless, it's odorless, it's tasteless. But also I love to trick my medical students, like how does a child with lead poisoning present? And they don't. It's asymptomatic. We don't see the consequences of lead exposure for years, if not decades. And those consequences are multifactorial. They could be caused by lots of other things too. So it's not something that you see right away. But it can appear in your blood, but the detection window in your blood is also very limited. It has something called a half-life of 28 days, and then it dissipates from your system.
So even though it dissipates, are the effects still present?
Absolutely. The effects are irreversible, and they're present. But it's not something that you often see right away. And the evidence and what lead does is based on the field of epidemiology, where we look at populations. So at a population level, children exposed to lead, for example, will have lower IQs, and they'll have more behavior problems, and they'll have, you know, the greater need for special education resources, and even it's even been linked to criminality. So this is what it does at a population, and here we've exposed this entire population to a neurotoxin.
It's just so shocking. I keep on thinking about you having recommended drinking this water, and then recognizing that there's a problem, and then you have a window that I'm sure you thought was closing. Can the effects be reversed? And were you then racing against time?
Absolutely. You pretty much wrote my book. So from the moment that I realized that there was this population-wide lead exposure, my focus went to the tomorrows of our children. We could not take this away. There's no pill. There's no antidote. There's no magic something to give these children. But there is so much that we are doing to mitigate, to limit, to buffer the impact of this exposure. And that's also what this book is about. It's It's about the hope. It's about how we use science to expose this crisis, but also how we are using the science of brain development and of resilience to make sure that our children recover from this crisis. So right now in Flint, we are wrapping our children with science-based interventions to promote their development. Things like early literacy, books are brain food for kids. Great nutrition. We have Medicaid expansion. We have mobile grocery stores. We have two brand new child care centers. We have near universal preschool. And I can go on and on and on. These are all evidence-based interventions that promote children's development. And we are taking this broad wraparound public health approach to make sure that we don't see the consequences of this crisis. And we have to do this. These kids did nothing wrong besides live in a city that was near bankrupt, that changed its water supply, that didn't treat it properly, and were exposed. And we have an ethical, moral, and a professional obligation to do absolutely everything so that we do not see the consequences.
Numbers are so powerful. How many kids are we talking about?
So there's about 10,000 children under the age of 6. There's about 140,000 people that were exposed to this crisis, but we worry about the littlest ones. Like your last guest spoke about this period of brain plasticity. There's this period, this prenatal, the preschool period, where our brains are developing the most. And when you're exposed during that time, that's when it has the greatest impact. So that's where a lot of our energy is focused, on that youngest age group, which is about 10,000 kids, although there's resources in place for the entire population, but obviously more work to do.
So there was more than just lead poisoning, although that's sort of the big crux. We also had an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease as well.
Great. So yeah, this is not just a lead crisis. The water crisis is broad. So we had one of the largest outbreaks of Legionnaire's disease. Legionnaire's disease is a pneumonia that usually older immunocompromised people get. It's from the same mechanism with the water switch. The water switch with the corrosive water ate up chlorine, which is a disinfectant, but it also created this perfect milieu for the overgrowth of this pathogenic bacteria. And that 12 people died from Legionnaire's disease. There was an uptick in overall mortality, pneumonia mortality, that may have been attributed to that. So that's why we have some of these negligent homicide charges against officials. We also had widespread skin issues. That was one of the first manifestations of this drama, were skin issues and rashes, maybe from the bacteria, maybe from the added chlorine.
Is it just a rash or something else?
All kinds of different things. There was exacerbated things like eczema, just irritation. People would bathe their children and there would be like a rash developed up to that water line.
Where the line went across a toddler's chest, yep. You'd have development all underneath.
Pretty much lots of different things. Hair loss.
Among kids,
older people as well. But the biggest thing that we see is just the trauma of the crisis. And like you said, it's an ongoing crisis. So in Flint, we're still on filtered and bottled water. And it's that everyday trauma of trying to bathe your child, make your coffee, brush your teeth, figure out where you're going to get that water from. And just that trauma, that anxiety, that fear, that anger, that guilt, that stress, just that stress alone can lead to chronic diseases as well.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha about her new book, What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. And welcome back. I'm talking with Dr. Hanna. Dr. Mona. I know everyone calls you Dr. Mona.
Dr. Mona's great.
So, you write a lot about Brad Werfel, the communications director for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. You called him chief villain and attack dog of the Snyder administration. Why?
Well, he went after everybody who was raising concerns in the water crisis. He went after the citizens. He went after Mark Edwards, a renowned engineer who shared the evidence that there was lead in the water. And he went after me.
He went after you. How did he go after you?
After I publicly released our research showing that there was more children with elevated lead levels after the water crisis, he said that my research was unfortunate, called me an unfortunate researcher. And then the other kind of arms of the state also said I was causing near hysteria, splicing and dicing numbers, that essentially I was wrong.
essentially you were wrong, and yet you continued fighting back. What gave you the strength to do that?
The kids. It's the kids. So it was my duty, like I said, to fight for these kids. I knew my science was right. I knew my numbers were right. And every single number that was part of my research represented a child that I had probably cared for in that last year or so. And it was the kids who gave me that fight to keep fighting.
At one point, didn't he also say Flint's drinking water is safe and that it's meeting state and federal standards? And I say that with quotation marks.
Yeah, he also said everybody, anyone worried about lead in the water should just relax.
Would he drink the water?
I don't know. He also called Mark Edwards, who's a MacArthur genius, who's one of the world's leading experts on lead and water. He said that wherever he goes, he pulls rabbits out of hats, implying he pulls lead out of water wherever he goes. So there were many reports about the water crisis, including one from the governor created a task force about what happened. And they specifically pointed out his actions and his words. And if only he had spent as much time looking into the crisis than attacking folks, we would have been a lot better off.
Did he ever say, I'm sorry?
He did. And it's in the book. He did. We happened to be side by side at a press conference. And I turned over and he was there and he apologized. You know, I don't need the apologies, and I'm not looking for apologies. The people of Flint need the apologies, but more than that, they need action.
Now, they forced him to resign, is that right?
He resigned, yes, as well as the director of the Department of Environmental Quality resigned.
Now, I know you're not doing this in order to sort of save your own name because you're focused on the kids, mm-hmm. but did you feel vindicated?
There's no vindication. I wish they proved me wrong. I wish I was wrong, because then that would have meant that kids weren't exposed to lead and that there wasn't this crisis. So there's no like congratulations or good job or you were right. I wish I was wrong, because I wish this wasn't the case.
You come from a family of fighters. I know you come from an Iraqi family. And your dad actually drew a lot of public attention because he was against Saddam Hussein's crimes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am an immigrant. I was not born in this country. And, you know, this part of the story probably would not have played such a big role as it did if not for the current political climate. So we came here for that American dream. We came here fleeing oppression, fleeing tyranny, fleeing fascism, fleeing the regime of Saddam Hussein. And that American dream absolutely worked for my family. But I very much grew up knowing what injustice was, knowing what governments could do to their people. The first time I remember seeing a picture of a dead baby was the poisoning of the village of Halabja in northern Iraq, where 5,000 people were poisoned, where a government poisoned its own people. And that picture had never escaped my mind. It was probably what pushed me into going into medicine and service. But that is how I grew up, and that's part of the story. And I couldn't separate it from the story. My upbringing, my background as an immigrant in a place of injustice, because that's how I see the world, and that's what's framed my work and especially my work in this crisis.
I'm struck by that image of you seeing a photograph of a child who is dead because of government poisoning. In that situation, it may have been malicious.
Yeah.
But in Flint, Michigan, there were also children who were being poisoned, also by the government. Hopefully that wasn't malicious, but did you see parallels within those two?
Yeah, there are parallels, but absolutely different stories. I mean, Saddam Hussein was a megalomaniac. He woke up wanting to poison children. And I don't think anybody in the story woke up wanting to poison children. You know, it happened and there was cover-ups, but you know, it's a different situation. But I knew what governments could do and their capability for evil. Or their lack of caring for children, especially.
Did your parents ever say, hey, what are you doing? We came to this country to not be in the spotlight, to not be against the government, and here you are, the daughter of of Iraqi immigrants, fighting the U.S. government about a situation where people were after you.
Yeah, my mom, I talk a lot about my mom in the book. My mom is a worrier. she grew up losing friends and hearing terrible stories. And to this day, she's the classic immigrant mom who was strict and has curfews. And, you know, to this day, she tells me what to wear and what not to wear. So growing up in that milieu very much, put an additional kind of level of anxiety and fear for my parents as I was going through this crisis. But my parents, I learned from them, and I learned that I need to raise my voice and I need to speak out for populations that may be more vulnerable and to do what is right. So despite their worry and their anxiety and their stress, they knew that I was doing the right thing and they supported me.
If we could focus on the governor, you do not hold your tongue when it comes to the governor. You've come out against him, but you also see him as a whole person now. Is that right?
Yeah, so this is tough. And there's I think something that I've learned in this crisis and also writing this book is that it's not black and white. There's not good guys and bad guys. There's people in between. I work with the governor. I work with his team. Because I'm going to have to work with him. And I'm going to have to work with the next five governors. Like, the only political party that I am espoused to are to children. Like, that's my constituency. So I will work with whomever is in power to make sure that kids get what they need. So I'm also kind of a glass half full kind of person. Mm-hmm. I'm also this innate optimist, and I want to believe the good in everybody. This governor could have gone on for years denying this crisis. That's what happened in Washington, D.C. when they had a similar lead and water crisis. It was years and years of denial, and that's what we were expecting. But this governor actually said, I apologize. There's a problem. I'm going to fix it. He didn't have to say that, but he did. So I'm going to take that, and I'm going to continue to work with him and with whomever for the best interest of our children.
So some of the problems in the Flint water crisis were not just at the state level, but at the federal level. You note that emails between top government officials at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency expose, and these, to use your words, the callousness of government officials. In particular, you look at emails between the EPA Region 5 Water Division Branch Chief Debbie Baltzar to Susan Hedman. What do you think these emails reveal?
So that specific email said that Flint was not a city worth going out on a limb for.
Oh my gosh. That Flint was not a city worth going out on a limb for. That's such a loaded phrase.
I know. And I'm sure there was context, and I don't know the backstory, but when somebody from Flint hears that, or when anybody hears that, what does that tell you about us? Like, are these kids not important? Like, why are we not worth going out on a limb for? Because it happens to be a poor and minority city? Because we're near bankrupt? Should our water not be as safe as another city's water? So there was definitely fault at the federal level, at the EPA. And even after the crisis, the EPA Inspector General wrote a report and said that they should have acted 7 months sooner, because they knew and they could have done more as well.
So to this day, most faucets in Flint still use filters. Is that right?
Yeah, we're on filters and bottled water because of the pipe replacement that's happening, which is a good thing. So by 2020, Flint will have replaced all of our lead pipes, and we'll only be the third city in the country that's done that, behind Lansing, Michigan, Madison, Wisconsin, and in Flint. And we're doing it in less time than any other city.
It's sort of an extraordinary model that hopefully other cities will also follow.
Absolutely. And we hope all of our work is a model for other cities, especially our work around childhood recovery, that wraparound approach that we're taking to bring hope to the children of Flint, to bring that science of resilience for our children with parenting support and early intervention and childcare and healthcare access. What we do in Flint, we want to share with other communities, because there are Flints everywhere. There are children everywhere who are suffering from very similar situations, be it poverty, be it disinvestment, be it racism, be it lead exposure. So we really hope to share what we learn with other communities.
The government used to pay for the bottled water that residents were drinking. Not the case anymore.
Not anymore. So a few weeks ago, the state cut bottled water to Flint the same week that they gave Nestle almost unlimited access to Great Lakes water for a $200 fee per year. They cut bottled water to Flint.
But people are still drinking bottled water.
People are still drinking bottled water. And it not only was it a safety and access issue, the bottled water was also a bridge for affordability. During the crisis, people of Flint were paying the highest water rates in the country, the highest water rates for water they couldn't drink. To this day, the water is still very expensive for the city that is the poorest in the country. So having that bottled water was also a bridge for the affordability issue.
When you think about the budget for a family, any family, you know, if you have a little bit more wealth, you can deal with surprise expenses. But when you're just operating at the poverty level,
which doesn't even make ends meet at the poverty level,
how do you, what do you not have in order so you can drink water? What are you hearing?
So, I mean, it's extreme poverty. I mean, they don't have access to just the basic needs. I mean, and we see this every day. And we saw it even before the crisis. Families can't go to the doctor. They can't afford healthy food. And they can't just the basic necessities of life, not knowing where you're going to be able to live, not knowing how you're going to be able to make ends meet. So now it's even more difficult to get that bottled water. So they're relying on nonprofits, great agencies like the United Way and the Salvation Army who are helping provide that water. But it's still not enough.
If we could look at other cities, I know your research focused on Flint.
Mm-hmm.
The lessons learned, you have a lot of cities that are on sort of the brink. They could make similar mistakes.
Yeah.
What do you tell parents? What do you tell doctors? Because I stress this point, is it enough for parents to trust the doctors?
Yeah.
What are they to do?
Yeah, so I think that's an absolute lesson of this book. So what the eyes don't see. So the lesson is we can all open our eyes, and it doesn't matter who we are, be it a parent, a school teacher, a mom, a pediatrician. We can get informed. We can get educated. We can build a network. We can find colleagues. We can find partners, and we can make a difference. So Flint's also a story of amazing citizen activists, citizen science, community engagement, community empowerment, that are lessons all over. Sometimes we think that we are fighting fights all alone, be it a mom or whomever, but I think the power that Flint has showed us is that we can fight this people who may look different than us or act different than us and be in different professions set up, different professions as us who are fighting the same fights. For example, in this story, Mark Edwards, a water scientist from Virginia Tech, like, became my best friend. I'm like, what? I'm a pediatrician. Like, pediatricians, we have like the monopoly on caring for children. How could somebody else care as much about children? And like, hey, and a water engineer cares about children. So like, he looks different than me, and he acts different than me, and he votes different than me. But like, I think you'd be surprised on the power of team, and when you find these folks, the ability to make a difference.
And so there are cities like Flint, mm-hmm. all around the country, because we're undergoing a major reorganization in America where you have hyper-urbanization, you have pockets of extreme wealth in some cities. Then you have urbanization because people who can't live in the areas of wealth are congregating in other areas where something like this could potentially happen. What do you tell those folks who are in cities that are not prosperous, but they're clumping together because they have nowhere else to live? How do you not only fight for your right to actually have clean water and other environmental resources, but also convince someone, unlike that email that you received, that you and your city are worth fighting for?
Yeah, so I think it's being part of democracy. It's participatory democracy. So the central tenet of environmental justice is that you have a seat at the table. And I would encourage folks to have a seat at the table, to get involved, be it in your local school board or your city council, to get involved and be part of that democratic process. And it could be as simple as voting. I mean, that's a critical lesson here too, is you need to vote. But be part of democracy. Democracy is messy and it's loud and there's a diversity of voices, but that is critical to our society. And that's critical to hearing the diversity of the voices that are at the table to protect our communities.
Thank you so much for joining me today. Now, I've been speaking with Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha about her new book, What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. Tomorrow night at 7, Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha will be in conversation with Chelsea Clinton at BNN Union Square. That's at 33rd East 17th Street. 33rd East 17th Street.